Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
It's Anna David here, your host, your cheerful host. She's cheerful today. She's talking about herself in the third person for no reason. You know what? This is episode 25. Guess who decided to just get organized and count what number episode this was? I noticed, because I'm observant that way, that other podcasts oftentimes said, welcome to episode 364 or whatever it was, and that I never said that. I'm not great with numbers, but it does. That doesn't mean I can't count, and so I did. And so this is episode 25, which feels like a really good number to be on, don't you think? A quarter? You may have noticed, you noticed, right, that there was a new theme song. That was written, as always, by Seth Rothschild. That guy is so good. Are you following him on Twitter, etc.? Because he's so good. Basically, what I told him was that the show had a bit of a midlife crisis, which is not to say that there's only going to be 50 episodes. It's just that I started to realize that a couple things, like the Venn diagram of who I wanted on the podcast and who was sober and open about being sober, that crossover was getting smaller and smaller. And I started to think, well, that's no good. We can't run out of people. That's not a good business model or whatever. And I started to think also how to make the topic more universal. And so then I thought, most people who have any sort of brain, I don't mean that. Most people who are like into some sort of a spiritual path or have reached a certain point in life, possibly any person of 40 years old and older, has reached a point where they've had to overcome something, if not many things. And so I decided I want to open this up. I want to open this up to people who can talk about overcoming depression, mental illness, maybe someone who's lost 300 pounds. I don't know, 100 pounds. I don't have a pound idea in mind. But I do know that that I want to include those people. And I did go through this whole thing. You know, I'm a very dramatic thinker, so I thought, oh my God, I have to change the title and I have to do all this. And that seemed problematic. I did come up with some new titles before realizing that I didn't have to change the title and we could just change the theme music a little bit and include those people. So you have Seth Rothschild to thank for that. Now, guest today, really so delightful, Jason Waller. Do you remember that guy? He was on Laguna Beach in the Hills. Don't pretend you didn't watch those shows. They were our collective guilty pleasure. Okay, maybe I'm just talking to me. I was definitely a viewer. And he, you know, it's funny because we were talking about how he was considered a douchebag on the show. And comparatively speaking, there was Spencer Pratt, right? So I never thought he seemed Jason so douchey. But anyway, he did get arrested a lot for things like related to addiction, related to substances. And then he showed up on that season of Celebrity Rehab that had Janice Dickinson on it. And I told you I'm not good with numbers, so I don't know what number episode. But he seemed really serious about his sobriety, and he really was, because he's now sober 3 or 4 years. Told you, numbers not my thing. And he's so into it. If you guys could have seen him, he's like all like, not in a suit, but just like super dressed, like just he takes it seriously. And he's got that, you know, that passion to talk about addiction and recovery. He has no interest in being like on a TV show. And so he works in treatment, and he will tell us all about it. And he's earning his KDAC, which is that program that I was enrolled in and dropped out. So I'm impressed. And, you know, and it's sort of his life mission to help. It's very similar to mine, you know, sort of try to change the perception of addiction and recovery and destigmatize it. And he's doing all sorts of things to do that. And he's just a total delight and really, really, really sweet. So listen to him, check it out, send me emails, tweets, Facebook messages, letters, telegrams about what you think of this episode and the new song. I want to hear what you think of the new song. Okay. Love you guys. Bye.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Oh yeah, it's happening. Okay, since, you know, it was that, Jason Waller, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So, but you were saying something interesting, and I did that thing that I'll do, which is to say stop talking because we're not recording.
I'm used to girls saying that, so.
So, what you were saying was really interesting, which is we were talking about, you know, you blogging for the Huffington Post in the wake of the Philip Seymour Hoffman died. In terms of seeing how where society is in terms of their understanding about addiction, didn't you think the way that was reported and what came out was fascinating?
I just thought a lot of what was, I mean, for me personally, I'll kind of go into what my, you know, interpretation of everything was. I was kind of, I basically was writing about the Philip Seymour Hoffman thing in relation to what I've experienced personally.
Right.
And that's how I do everything. I'm not like, hey, this is what you need to do. This is what how you do. I share my personal truths and experiences, and whatever comes up of it is what it is. And the thing I related to is, you know, people were like, oh, and I never read the comments or stuff, but I mean, just being affiliated with a lot of the addiction stuff, I was focused on, you know, oh, it's his fault. Oh, it's, you know, he deserved that, da-da-da.
Or he was selfish.
Or he was selfish and stuff like that. And for me personally, what I talked about was how I could relate to that in so many levels. And I gave the example of I had a party. I would have multiple parties at my house, but I'd have, you know, 50 to 100 people over, and I'd go in my bathroom by myself and snort a bunch of cocaine pound a bottle of vodka and come out with a beer and, like, you know, come back to the party. Everything's fine.
Right.
But just that, you know, that total, you know, isolation and just that total misery of what I was suffering, I could relate to that. It's like this guy wasn't like at a raging party or something like that. Not that that wouldn't matter. The guy died in his bathroom with a needle in his arm. That doesn't sound too glorifying to me.
No.
I mean, the guy was super sad, super depressed. I think he was in a premeditated relapse prior to him even using. I mean, I think he lost touch with his program is what happened. That's my, you know, input on it.
Yeah.
Some people could believe it or not believe it, but I can relate to a lot of what he was going through, especially being, you know, knowledgeable on multiple different treatments because I've been a lot of times and just even when I was
How many rehabs total did you go to?
Nine.
Nine rehabs.
So, yeah, I mean.
And technically the one that worked was the celebrity rehab one? Or no, you were sober going
I was sober going into celebrity rehab, and I went there, as contradicting as it sounds, I went into celebrity rehab to show the public that I'm not as crazy as TMZ or Perez Hilton may make me, because that show was a real reality show where they follow you around. I mean, you only can act as stupid as you act, and I literally was a background prop on the show.
I know, you were so boring and great. Because, yeah. And I mean, I guess, like, I mean, that is a good way to do it. Be super.
Because my sponsor, everybody that was engaged in my program going into it, I only had a little bit of time going into it, you know, but everybody advised not to do it. And I was like, look, this is why I'm doing it. And I know you don't believe in it, but this is what I know I need to do. And it worked out because of this. I mean, everything happens for a reason. I'm here today talking with you. And that had to do something with that setup. And, you know, I have a very close relationship with our friend Dr. Drew.
Right.
I mean, very close, and do a lot of work with Bob Forrest. And,
right.
you know, I'm able to be able to speak about this, and it's something that is very close to me. It's a passion and stuff. I mean, you know, a lot of people know my addiction not, you know, only took me to not contemplating but attempting suicide.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it took me to the darkest places. And, you know, just to be able to share my personal truths and experiences, if it can help people, great. If not, you know, take someone else's advice. But I'm just trying to raise awareness and give insight.
Did you ever think you'd end up being this guy?
Are you kidding?
I mean, this is like the last guy you probably thought.
There's no, I mean, 4 years ago for you to, you know, say I would be, you know, the likelihood of me becoming and working in addiction or being somebody that is a spokesperson for it is the likelihood of me becoming a police officer or something that just was not going to happen.
Right.
Not that I have anything against police or anything, but
right.
it was just like, that's not my forte.
In your realm. Yeah.
So, you know, but anything can happen. And, you know, I believe, honestly, God put me here for a reason. That was to, you know, the shows and stuff, with the success of them, I feel like I was, you know, it was his plan almost. It was
Oh, really?
To be caught up in, you know, the negativity and the public humiliation and stuff, and it turned around for the better. I think he put me in that spot to show that you can get through addiction, and you know, I want to be a voice for it, and there's not too many people that are doing that, you know, especially in the entertainment business. And I don't think I'm some special person that's in there. I think I'm your average Joe, but I think I've had a lot of, you know, personal and public trials and tribulations that I can share on that people go through every day, you know, just because they're not on a show and it's not glorified like they made it, you know, to the public. They can still relate to it, you know.
So, okay, so what was your first drink?
What was my first drink?
When was it? How old were you?
Jeez. You're going to do that to me?
Uh-huh.
I want to say like 14.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember?
I do.
What happened? What was it like?
I was actually scared. The first drink I had, I drank a couple, because I was very active. I was very,
you know, just
into sports and everything growing up. And, you know, I didn't have any crazy trauma growing up. That's the thing. That's for me, I had a very, if anything, privileged life. I had parents that were still married. I had a very supportive family.
And they were so lovely on the show. I still remember the parent thing.
Thank you.
So nice and normal.
But that's the thing is, it's, for me, it wasn't like I'm trying to escape. Like, so I had a couple beers, and I actually pretended that I was like, whoa, man, this is so true, you know?
Wait, your first drink?
The first couple, I pretended that I actually got intoxicated, but I had two beers, I remember, and I wasn't. It was just kind of like, okay.
What was the circumstance? A friend said, hey, we should drink beer.
It was just kind of like, I'd started smoking cigars and like a cigarette here and there. You know, so it was just kind of like, we should get some beer. And our brother's, one of my best friend's brothers, I remember it exactly. He was 19, had his fake ID. We're like, dude, get us some beer.
Yeah.
We got 2 6-packs, you know. Right. One of the other friend got super, super annihilated, passed out right away.
Right.
And me and my friend were fucking with him the whole time.
Right.
Excuse me.
But, you can speak.
You know, we were just doing that whole thing. And, to me, I got to the point where I was like, dude, I do not want to be like that. I mean, because I was sipping on it.
Right.
You know, I was a very normal drinker at 14, you know. So
took a minute.
But it only took a couple years. But, you know, it was interesting. I remember it very, very, very vividly what had happened. I remember the truck we got picked it up out of from. I mean, like everything.
And yet it wasn't this magical aha moment. This is what I've been seeking my whole life.
If anything, I was fear of it and fear of what it was going to do. I liked having control over my thoughts and I like, you know, being present and, you know, I was in a good state of mind at that age and I had a lot going on positively, you know.
Do you have alcoholism at all in your family? Like an uncle?
Oh, do we?
Oh, interesting.
I'd say half my family suffers from addiction.
Okay.
At least. And we have a very, very large family.
Okay. Oh, so you cousins.
Cousins, aunts, uncles,
and did
grandparents.
You grow up hearing about that or noticing it or not really?
Well, to be honest with you, another thing, I mean, I was very blessed as in my parents and stuff. It didn't hit like my parents.
Right.
And I was too young to really know what was going on with, like, even though I was, you know, in my teenage years, I didn't know, like, my parents were very, kept the issues with my older brother and stuff confined. You know, they weren't going to elaborate to me what's going on.
How much older is he?
He's 8 years older than me.
Okay, so that's significant. Like it's
not like he's a year or two older. So I mean, it was, and it would do no good by them telling me anyways. I'd just be this fear and just kind of like, oh my god, that's the brother I look up to. Both of them I look up to.
Oh, so you have it's three kids all together.
Four of us.
Okay, is there a girl?
Yeah, there's my sister's the oldest. She's 36. My other brother's 33, and then my closest in age brother's 30.
And he was the one who was getting in trouble.
The oldest.
The oldest.
Because I'm 27. Yeah, so if he's. It's like a 6-7 year difference. Whatever
it is. So he would get in trouble. You didn't know.
But his stuff wasn't like he was getting arrested all the time and crazy stuff. It was just more of school, you know, dealing with grades. I mean, he had public intoxication and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I know this now, but it was very hush-hush in the beginning.
Right. And then, of course, okay, so then you know, when does it escalate? From the, like, 2 beers and I'm sort of faking it to, loving it.
I'd say, like, 17, 18.
Okay.
17, I mean, 18 was when it was like I was crushing vodka, like, constantly.
And you had Laguna Beach started then?
It was a little bit before. It was probably 6 months to a year before Laguna Beach was filming. That was like 17, 18. So it was actually like early 17, 16, not what we're talking about. Like now, it's late 16s, early into 17s is when I started drinking, you know, pretty heavily. But it was still, it wasn't like an everyday thing. It was, you know, Friday, it was like weekend warrior stuff, Friday, Saturday.
Right. And it's fun. You're having fun.
And little things started to surface. You know, I got a public, you know, intoxication. But I mean, like, the party at the house got raided. You know, it was just a bunch of cops came and just getting minor in possessions. But all the stuff that was going on, it wasn't like, obviously, looking back, I could see where there's concerns, but just from somebody's standpoint, looking at the situation, it's just us kids being in high school, experimenting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There was no, wasn't like we were doing these crazy, crazy things. You know what I mean? I was still cautious of not drinking and driving, still, you know what I mean? There was a lot of stuff that, I mean, that's not normal to have, you know, to even think about anyways, but.
That's what I never know. I mean, I grew up, obviously, as like an alcoholic teen. I didn't know that at the time. And I was surrounded by people who were the same. It was obviously totally normal that you were like looking to get your fake ID and that you were like going to get busted by cops. Like,
well, and it didn't
and I
help
get now that it's not normal that other kids are not growing up like that. But I had no idea.
But it didn't help, though, that I had facial hair at 17 years old.
Oh.
And I could go into most liquor stores, honestly, and just buy alcohol.
Didn't card you? They just assumed.
I've always looked older than my age. And,
right.
And I mean, when I looked, I think it was a lot of people that just didn't really care. I mean, in Laguna and stuff. But I mean, some places really believe that I was, you know, 20. Because a lot of the friends I hung out with, too, it wasn't like I looked like I was older than I had a bunch of young kids with me. It was like a lot of my friends were older. I didn't have anybody.
Right.
You know what I mean? So guys that were really 18, 19, 20, you know, when I was 17. So I kind of like fit in with them. They all had fake IDs, but. I mean, I had
so you
never access.
You used your brother's ID or anything?
I always had access. Well, I did steal his ID once in the beginning.
Yeah.
That didn't work out too well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he wanted to give me a beat down, so.
Really?
Yeah. He was pissed because he had to go to the DMV and get a new ID and all that stuff, so I had to make amends about that for sure.
I bought a fake birth certificate when I was, like, 19, and I went to the DMV in California and got, like, that's...
I didn't know they had fake. You could buy fake birth certificates.
Well, the thing was, it was somebody who went to Cal, and his dad was a gynecologist, and that was like the big thing. He had the stamp. There's like a California stamp, and he was like, "This is, you know, this is how we can do it. We got the California stamp."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
So like, kind of evolving from all that when things started going crazy and stuff. You know, then the show came out, and then I mean, that's when things. I mean, that's when shit started to hit the fan. I mean, most kids at 18,
right?
You know, looking for fake IDs or stuff like that. I was. You know, my friends were looking for fake IDs, and I was being paid to travel and party.
So you get on the show, and were you ever like, oh, my God, I drink a lot. Maybe I should be careful when these cameras are on me?
I mean, on the show, I mean, there was a lot of times – there was times definitely when I was drunk, but there was a lot of times where I wasn't. I mean, they filmed on the week. It's not like they could film during school hours and stuff like that. So a lot of the times they caught us was when we were actually outside of the element of school and stuff like that.
Right.
But I honestly, as much as, you know, as a douche as I came off and different things like that, I just, you know, I partied. I'd say it wasn't like the norm. I mean, I definitely partied harder than most of the kids. But, I mean, there was a large group of us that we kept up with each other. And I just thought I was going to grow out of it, honestly.
Yeah.
I'm not going to accept the fact that I'm having all this fun, getting paid all this money. And, you know, I'm going to say, oh, I'm an alcoholic. I mean, there's no way.
So when did you, so you're on Laguna Beach. And it's all working.
Mm-hmm.
Did it ever get totally out of control when you were just like, oh God, I am so interesting that I am worth following my like, you know what I mean? Since that's not, well, you're still in your formative years, the brain is not fully formed till which one.
Well, I think anybody, I mean, naturally the human wants to be liked by people and just stuff like that. So, I mean, obviously when you go from just going to school and going to baseball and, you know, surfing and stuff, and then you go outside and people are like, can we get your photo? People are running up to you. I mean, your ego naturally is just going to build.
Respond, yeah.
And
but
so,
you had healthy self-esteem from your
family. I did growing up and stuff. And I mean, but I had, you know, insecurities about things a lot of people wouldn't know that I had growing up.
What?
Just insecurities with looks and just, you know, because I mean, I felt like I had a lot of friends and stuff, but even though on the outside it was there, a lot of it internally to me didn't feel like it was there. It was just a lot of unsureness about myself.
Right,
and
right.
I always, you know, needed, you know, people to either it was like stroke the ego or, you know, get, you know, basically, you know, make me believe what I would, you know, I'd question things and I'd make sure that I'd get the answers I wanted to hear. Just, yeah, reassuring. That's exactly the word I was looking for. But, so I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of signs that at the immediate time I didn't see as, a, you know, raising red flags. Now that I look at it, I'm able to talk about it. But so there was a lot of that going on and, you know, just a lot of uncertainty of myself. But, I mean, my drinking and stuff, I mean, everything, my favorite quote, and I say this almost on every interview or radio show or anything, is I had and I still suffer sometimes from an overinflated ego with an underestimated sense of self-worth. And I think a lot of that came from the shows, and because people are like, oh, do you blame? I was going through a bunch of old magazines and stuff. My mom was able to save a bunch of PR stuff. And,
right.
Which was cool because I was able to see certain things like, oh, the Hills made me a drunk or Laguna Beach and this. It's like, it really didn't. It escalated things. It made things happen much quicker because of the excess and all that stuff that I had from it. So, if anything, I'm thankful for it.
Right, because you got to get sober younger.
Exactly.
You know, and that's like, people will try to say that even to me, like, L.A. made you an addict. Anybody who, you know, it's like, and I say, you know, if I went to Des Moines and I was on a farm, farm. I would have found the farmhand Michelle Cook on the side. Like, that just was how I worked, you know?
Well, that's a simple saying of, there you go, there you are. I mean, yeah. Wherever you go, you're going to be present with it. And I have that ism. So, I mean, like I said, the show's escalated everything much quicker.
Right.
If I wasn't on the shows, I went to college and stuff like that, maybe I would have found out at a young age still. But my guess is that eventually it would have been over time, and I could have been 30 with kids. And, you know, it was a slow progression. That's right. Where Drew, I think, nailed it on the head. It's like it just added fuel to the fire.
Right, right. When I came into recovery, I started to hear, like, exactly what you said. I'm the piece of crap in the center of the universe. You've heard that one.
Yeah.
You love that one.
Yeah.
And I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, kind of, you know.
That's my favorite one.
It nails it so, it's just so right. And it's so, I don't know for you, but, like, for me, that was, like, I would never have connected that to my partying. Or, like, what does that have to do with, like, what I do at night or whatever?
100%. No, it really does. And that's where a lot of those signs and stuff, like, there was a lot of denial too. I mean, because when I did start getting into trouble, like, a perfect example of a lot of that is, you know, I'd be sitting there, and this is after, like, I got arrested 4 times in 6 months in 4 different states, all on appearances or at the VMAs or something like that. And I was sitting there, and it ties into this whole thing that I have a mugshot, which I'll get into after.
Okay.
But I'd be sitting there looking at the screen like, oh my god, drinking, like, I can't believe I got arrested again. I mean, obviously I knew there was a problem, but I'd be sitting there, that's the insanity of it.
Right.
Like, I'm sitting there drinking my sorrows away. Why did this happen as I'm drinking?
Right.
And it's like, well, because that happened, because what you're doing right now, you know, like,
did you think it was bad luck? You just thought you were terribly unlucky or being targeted or something?
At one point, I mean, that's how much denial I was, and I believe that. But I mean, which is amazing now, how I've utilized and don't dwell on things in the past like I used to. Like I said, I used to drink over stuff like that. I actually have a picture of it out of the 10 mugshots I have of an 8x10 of my favorite but most humiliating, you know, time in the public. It looked, everybody related to the Mel Gibson mugshot where my eyes are super pinned, totally cracked out. But I have that by my toothbrush, and it's been there the last 3.5 years, almost 4 years since I've been sober. So I can look at that. And that was the picture I used to drink over, like, not just looking at the picture, but all the stuff that would come out in the media. I would keep drinking over that and trying to, you know, push it away. But that's something now that I look at as a reminder not to dwell on anymore, but something to, you know, remind me.
And why it's like, you're sober.
Exactly. It's like, okay, you can dwell on that and go back to that, or you can use it as a motivation to move forward.
So, okay, so when did drugs come into it?
Drugs are always in and out.
Really?
Yeah.
Cocaine, mostly.
That was
my favorite.
Coke, yeah. I mean, and I did coke so I could sober up enough to drink more.
Oh, really?
And so, I mean, so I wouldn't black out. I knew once I figured out I could do a bunch of blow and I wouldn't black out.
Right.
I'd rather have the horrible come down instead of blacking. I literally couldn't drink myself. I couldn't drink enough to fall asleep. That's how much coke I was doing and how much my body was able to retain alcohol.
Right. And so your arrests were for possession? Like, what were they for?
Everything was, so, like, I keep clarifying on all the shows, I had one DUI.
Okay.
Everybody thinks I have, like, 20.
Okay.
But
that's creative to get arrested, like, 9 times and only have one DUI.
Right?
Good
so
work.
It was, like, minor possession. So a lot of them were happening when I was, so minor in possession, you know, that happened a couple times.
Right. Possession of cocaine.
I got possession of cocaine at the VMAs.
How do you get possession of cocaine at the VMAs? Like, what?
Well, it was after an after party. It wasn't like at the VMAs.
Right,
it was
that would
after,
be amazing.
I got into it with a horse cop. That was pretty entertaining.
What do you mean? So you're at an after party and a horse cop?
It was
cop,
me,
is there?
Little John. There was a bunch of us went to this after party, and, you know, he always goes out with his, he leaves with his whole crew, and it was me and like a few buddies.
Little
and stuff.
John,
yeah.
Like, okay.
It was random. It was
friends
from Oakley and stuff were really good. That's how we all entered. There was a lot of, I have a lot of random connections in the business, but really cool guy. And, you know, when we left, we went in this the back way, and then we left, you know, through the front. And as opposed to going to where they're directing us, I went and hopped over the gates. And a big horse cop came up and just knocked me over, like, saved me from going into traffic. But I was in a blackout.
Wait, you were on foot?
Yeah, I was on foot leaving the club.
Okay, so you're leaving a club and a horse. Okay.
Because in New York, there's a lot of.
I'm in
New York at the VMAs, so
okay,
I'll make that more clear. So when we went in the club, we went in the back way, and then
right.
When we came out, I thought I was going to hop over the gate that we went out the front to go back kind of the way we came. But all that was closed off because traffic was moving again and stuff like that. And they have horse cops out there.
Right.
So I, instead of going with the whole crew, I thought I was, you know, just being a smart ass. And
right.
Jumped over the gate and the big horse cop knocked me over and, you know, went from there. And I had coke on me and stuff like that. So, I mean, I wasn't being the most well behaved or complying with the officers.
Oh,
so,
you weren't?
No.
Were you like?
I was just hammered.
You didn't do a Do You Know Who I Am? Did you?
No.
Okay.
No, I was just more like, get the fuck out of my way! I'm trying to get through to our car
because
our car was right next to, like the limo was across the street, so
right.
I was just trying to get to the car, you
right.
know. And, of course, I mean, the ego came into play where I was just like, dude, come on, we're all trying to get out of here, you know? And everybody's,
right.
like, trying to stop what was going on, but I was being erratic, and then I went into, like, a rage. And
oh, you did?
Yeah, so then it just transformed into just a messy situation.
Really? So then you got, it wasn't just possession, it was, like, resisting
arrest. Well, it was resisting arrest, yeah. So from all those, and then it was, you know, I got arrested for a few times for fighting, and then... Yeah, it was all very similar. I mean, it was
yeah.
possession or fighting. I mean, there was nothing like super out of the norm.
And would the network say to you, like, hey, Jason, you got to clean this up? Or did they
No,
not,
it was amazing.
Good
it was good publicity. Because
right.
it gave the character, like, I was portrayed on
the
show.
The bad boy.
That and just, like, the guy's guy, the drunk guy, like, the,
right.
the drunk womanizing, like.
Right.
And it played into a character that was beneficial. I mean, it was on, it went forever, you know what I mean? And it's nice to have literally a 180, you know,
yeah.
turn. Yeah. So
did anybody say I'm worried about you?
Oh, all the time.
Okay.
I mean, my real friends, you know, honestly, that had my best interest at heart and stuff, were like, dude, you either get clean or we're not going to be around you. And, I mean, over time, I mean, I lost not just a few. I mean, like, tens to hundreds of friends. I mean, just, like, good people and relationships and family members and stuff that weren't going to support it. But when you're 18, 19, when your parents don't have financial control over you, like
right.
most people do,
right?
You know, what are they going to do? And to me, it was just like, okay, so that's the thing. It's like you attract like-minded people. So I kept pushing the good people away,
yeah.
kept getting more shady people in my life. And it was more, they were just there to co-sign the bullshit and ride the coattails. And
right.
when that all ran out, then they all went away. And, you know, so it was just kind of, it was a sticky situation, but a lot of it was just growing up and dealing with a lot of things that, you know, I had to deal with.
And so when was the first time that you said, oh my God, I might actually be an alcoholic or an addict?
I mean, it was probably in the middle of all that was going on. I knew when it was after the high school and I moved up to LA and I started seeing, like, I started blacking out a lot and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. So, I mean, it wasn't like I couldn't pinpoint, like, oh my God, I realize I've been, like, because I was in the thick of things. It wasn't like I was drinking so much that I couldn't even tell you exactly where it was. You know, it wasn't like
right.
one day I had this, like, oh my God, I feel horrible for everything.
Right.
I was just, I mean, I knew there was an issue, and it was like my disease was so deep that it was like there was no stopping it at that point. It was like, then it went to, I mean, from all the car crashes, the fights, everything that I shouldn't have been around for
right.
after that. I mean, then it went into, you know, not contemplating, but taking 20 Antabuse and, you know, potentially committing suicide.
So a doctor prescribed you Antabuse because you couldn't stop drinking.
Correct. It was part of a legal situation.
Part of a legal situation. Mm-hmm. You were taking it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Antabuse does not seem like a great way to try to kill yourself anyway.
No, I think I could be wrong on this. I don't know how many pills it was, but I know the guitarist of the Eagles died from Antabuse.
Okay.
I'm almost positive. Don't quote me on that, but I think he only had a few in his system. He tried drinking because it's like flu-like symptoms.
So,
your body.
Did you drink on them too?
Oh, I took 20 of them and pounded a fifth.
Right. And what happened to you?
My ex-fiance at the time, she saw me, like, what had happened. She saw the pills were gone. It was within, like, 30 minutes because I was in the living room, and she called the paramedics.
She was home.
Yeah, she was home. And I was just kind of just chilling in the living room, not really planning on anything, and then they rushed me to the hospital.
And they pumped your stomach, and so you never had
like
to, like...
They put, like, a black tar in it. It was crazy.
Oh,
was
God. And you were awake for it, or not really?
I was blacked out. I mean,
right.
That's the thing, is it wasn't like I was sitting there, like, totally coherent. I'm
there.
Like, I'm going to kill myself. It was more like, okay, I'm miserable as hell. I can't stop drinking. I can't stop this. Things just keep getting worse. I can't get out of it, or they'll just end it.
And so your thoughts before you did that was just that? Was just like, I can't get out of this?
I was just so deep. It was just like, legally, financially, I mean, just... relation, everything had just gone so, I mean, it was beyond rock bottom. It was more of like, because at the moment, I mean, I had everything you could potentially, you know, want. I mean,
right.
materialistically, girls,
right.
houses, I mean, cars, whatever you wanted. I mean, and I grew up fortunate too, you
right.
know, and I was raised right. I knew the value of dollars and stuff. I mean, all that stuff just slowly, my you know, good conscience and stuff like that started slipping away. And I mean, even when I had all that stuff, like I said, with the parties and stuff like that, and everything that was there is like when I was by myself, I was so lonely and so depressed, even though I could have 100 people over or different
right.
things. It was just all for the, you know, for show. And it
right.
was, and when it came down to sitting there, I was the most uncomfortable person in my own skin. And
And so you would go to treatment, and would you co-sign? Would you pretend to be into it? Would you be into it and then just relapse after?
No, it's like the first, I mean, because I went to treatment the first time I was like 17, 18, 19. I mean, it was like, right. I was started going at 17, 18.
Right. You know, like, summer camp.
Like when we were talking about to go back, you know, like when the drinking started escalating and stuff, I did go to a treatment. It was more of like to appease the parents. So it was because grades were, you know, and I was ditching school. It was more of like, okay, I'll go to treatment. It wasn't like I saw an issue there, because that's when people started noticing, okay, there could be an issue.
Right.
But they just thought I was being rebellious and stuff like that, more of like attitude. They didn't think I was drinking. So, because I don't want to sound contradicting on what we've talked about before. So, when that was when it started happening, but it was the first six that I had gone to, it was more courts, girlfriends, family, to get people off my back. I'll go,
I mean, would you listen? Would you hear anything?
Yeah, that's why, I mean, literally, I have more knowledge and treatment than I do most school. You know what I mean? Because I, like, 9 years, and I mean, I went to pretty good places. So, I mean, I was working with the best doctors, and that's sort of the thing. It was just like I wasn't vulnerable enough to open up and stuff like that. But when I was there, it wasn't like I was dicking around. I was paying attention. I took it in. I mean, that's the worst thing, though, having a head full of AA and all this, you know, NA, all this stuff, and then a belly full of drugs. I mean, as they say, it was not, it wasn't very fun. The highs started becoming less and less appealing and more, you know, demoralized. You know, it was just not a good thing.
And so when was the time that you were, so the last time you went, was it you were finally like, okay.
Well, this is what the big moment that changed was, I can't even remember, I'm working, it's funny, because I'm going to have you help me with a book, because I'm writing just all
You know, I wrote Tom Sizemore's book, by the way.
Did you really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Because I'm writing all these elements out, because I mean, I have, you know, sobriety dates July 23rd, 2010, so I mean, my head's starting to get more and more things that keep happening. But I remember, like, the moment, that turning point. So after the whole suicide thing, and the DUI happened actually at the end.
Right.
It was towards the very end. Right. My parents were just like, okay, that was, you know, after when I was saying, like, all the rest that happened in New York, Seattle, all the different times.
Right.
So the DUI was kind of, luckily I wasn't driving, didn't hurt anybody. I was actually pulled over in a red. They were telling me to move. And that's when they rolled down the window. You could just... I was arguing with a girlfriend at the time, and it just reeked of alcohol. So luckily, I didn't hurt anybody or anything, but that all transitioned into...
Was The Hills over at that point?
The Hills were... Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I wasn't on it anymore. I think it was when Kristen came back, and it was like the last season. So, but I was kind of doing my own thing at this point. And I started moving... I was back in Orange County and still up here, so I was going back and forth. But I was pulled over, but that transitioned into us going to another... I mean, out of the 1,000 therapy sessions we went to with my family and stuff... Where my dad, you know, like I said, the very close dynamic with them, you know, very respectable. He's, you know, he's intimidating too, in a good way, just a business savvy kind of person.
Right.
And me and my mom and dad are sitting there, keep in mind they've been married for 42, 43 years and stuff. And, you know, they got married at 18. Our family dynamic's super, super close. But he sat there and he started breaking down. I've only seen him cry one other time when his mom died. And he just sat there and he was just like, you know, our relationship, you know, our marriage is suffering. Not that they're going to get divorced and stuff, but, you know, there's no intimacy. There's no emotion left. And when he goes, we're like two planks of wood laying in bed waiting for the phone call. You're dead now. You know, it was past just getting arrested and stuff. It's like, okay, that's when it was like, okay, I don't care. I mean, clearly I didn't care enough about myself, you know, because I wanted the suicide thing was probably a year before that, you know, and it wasn't transitioned enough into anything. So, but when I heard that, I go, I don't care enough about myself, but I care enough about my parents and, you know, everybody else around. So that was my motivation in the beginning, because I honestly didn't care. I was just
I get that.
And,
yeah.
You know, but that's where it's for me in the big book and stuff like that. It wasn't for me in the beginning. That's something that is different. It was for my family. And I think a lot of people have to do it for themselves. Don't get me wrong, because it transitioned into for myself after.
Well, it's like, have you ever heard that thing in recovery? They say, don't kill yourself in the first year because you're killing the wrong person. It's like, you don't even know who you are. And let us love you until you love yourself.
100%.
Like an addict or an alcoholic doesn't care about him or herself.
Well, so you nailed that. I mean, but I think for a lot of people that come into it, it's like, well, you had to hit bottom, especially people that are not dealing, they're more like in the Al-Anon side or dealing with a loved one. It's like, they have to understand sometimes... there is a motivation from the other end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though, you know, you can't guarantee, I mean, that's the hopelessness and the powerlessness that you're not going to be able to fix them. That's guaranteed. But at the same time, you can be a motivation for them.
Well, yeah. And you did it for them until it hooked in and you saw and you were doing it.
It was like
yourself.
6 months until I transitioned into myself, and that actually life was getting better. But I mean, it was a full year before, like, you know, things were way good. And that's what I was told by my sponsees, like, or my sponsor. He said, you know, get a year. And I, you know, because if you get a year and things don't change and your life isn't a lot better, I'll take you back with the, you know, a couple grand cash, drop you off at the bar that I guarantee your bar stool hasn't moved and your friends are still there.
Right.
I'll drop you off.
Right.
And a year came around, I go, yeah, I'm not going. You know, we can go to a meeting.
See, interesting. My first year was dreamy and amazing every day, and I'm not even kidding.
Pink cloud over there.
Yeah, and it made 2, 3, 4 really rough. So I envy those people, but I envy, but I also don't get how you would stay. So like you got in and you were like depressed or what happened?
No, it was just like, I mean, I hadn't felt for so long. I was so used to just getting my way. I mean, just a lot of that, the ego stuff and just the entitlement and all that stuff. I mean, it was hard when you have that and then it goes away. It wasn't like, and that was the worst thing for me. But when all this stuff it was just two different lives in itself. I mean, I had all this, everything. It's like, how did all this, and I look at like, just different friends and different people that I'd lost and everything that they've gained. And it's like, it's almost like that looking like, okay, I've lost everything. I'm like over in this corner when I could have had everything.
Right. And so literally like you're not like on a TV show anymore.
Well, it's not even materialistic stuff. Right. It's just emotionally. It's like, dude, people are getting married. Friends are having kids. It's like, sweet, dude, I went through 10 different girlfriends in the last 6 months. Yeah, I was gay. I mean, just more of just the internal stuff. I mean, because materialist, I mean, like I said, I grew up fortunate. I was, you know, and I gained more. Like, and that's a part of my story. It's like I didn't have to experience crazy, you know, lifestyle growing up. I wasn't beaten. I didn't have trauma. I didn't have all this different stuff that some people it turns into an addiction for them. You know, that transitions to them for an addiction. But
well, my theory, by the way, I mean, whatever, who cares? It's just my theory. But it's not even that original. But it's just sort of you're born with a predisposition for alcoholism, and your circumstances can either exacerbate or diminish that predisposition.
I totally believe.
And so it's like trauma can certainly exacerbate it, but so can getting your ego fed in this like ridiculous way for no reason.
We're on the same point. It's a disease. I believe it is.
Yeah.
And I believe that you're born with it. Exactly what you said is exactly the way I believe it. I think there's different things that can instigate certain situations and make things harder or, you know, or easier or worse. But that's the thing. I mean, you nailed it with saying that.
Yeah. But I do think, I don't know the statistics. Drew told me once a crazy statistic. Oh yeah. Yeah. This is slightly off topic, but he heard it at a medical conference, and he said he's never seen it in print, and I completely Googled trying to find it, and I couldn't. But it's 100% of – some doctor said 100% of people who suffer from chronic pain were abused. I mean, I'm getting off topic, but that's insane.
No, that's crazy.
But it makes so much sense.
I could see that.
So you get sober, it's kind of rough, but you have a sponsor, you're doing the deal.
Mm-hmm.
You're not like being defiant or whatever. You go on Celebrity Rehab, 6 months into that or something?
I ended up being clean, it was about, going into it, I was only a couple months clean.
So you get a call, your agent's like, hey Jason, you got an offer from Celebrity Rehab.
Yeah.
And you say, what?
At first, I actually got offered a couple years prior to that, and I was like, no way, not doing that. I got all this other stuff going on. But like I said, it was more of, when it came back around, I believe it resurfaced for a reason. And it wasn't like, I mean, and to work with Drew and, you know.
And you knew him at that point?
No, I never met him still.
Okay.
But I did get offered, you know, through people out in New York, actually a PR firm that I knew wasn't working with. They were like, they want you on the show. And I was like, I'm not doing it. And, you know, just other things were going on. And so when it came around, it was kind of like I was getting clean. I was like, this could be an opportunity because a lot of that public humiliation had come out in those 2 years.
You know?
So it was kind of like a timing thing and everything. It just landed, and I was like, I'm going to take advantage of this.
But were you like, oh, God? Was part of you like, oh, God, what if I don't stay sober? It'll just contribute to the problem? Or you kind of knew you were committed at that point?
I knew I was committed. I mean, but...
You never know.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, it was a day at a time. I mean,
Trust
me, there was multiple times where it was like, potential slips and stuff, you know, especially
when you were on the show.
No, after the show and stuff. And so, I mean, it was initially for me was the best thing I saw that could happen, especially with everything that was going on. I wanted to just change my image to the public.
So, and if I remember your season right, don't think I didn't watch this show obsessively. It like hits exactly what I'm interested in.
Tell the meter.
Okay. Yeah. You know what? It's kind of become a recurring thing on the show that we actually discuss the meter. Not that listeners enjoy it, but it's fine. It's like humanity.
Yeah.
You know, right? That's why I love podcasts, because you actually, it's not this perfectly, you know, formed PR experience.
I love it.
So we have 15 minutes still?
Yeah.
We got tons of time.
Well, 15 minutes till I got to be out.
Okay. So let's do 10 more. And then we stop. And then you're going to come back.
I'm coming back. We're doing this again.
But no.
Oh, today?
Well, hold on. Let's see what we can get through.
Okay.
We're wasting. Like, I just wasted 30 seconds.
Let's go. We got it.
So, Okay, so you... what was my question? So you...
So after Celebrity Rehab...
Oh, yeah, so your season was the one with the other Jason who was, like, acted like a real douchebag. So you looked as, like, comparatively speaking... Because he was the one, he was, like, instigating all that stuff with Janice and all that.
So, I mean, like, Janice and Jason, I mean, and bless their heart. I mean, they were suffering through a lot of... Yeah. I mean, they're sick. And that's the thing is, you know, they were going through a lot, but, I mean... For me, I was just sitting back.
I just think of you sitting by the pool. I, like, remember lots of you sitting by the pool. And
just observing. Well, because, I mean, when I was spending time with Drew and Bob, people I really respect and that are really knowledgeable about, you know, I took that in. I really did.
Right.
And, you know, so after that show kind of, you know, went through and I was able to, you know, the public image, it worked. I mean, there was different people that wanted me to do their marketing and stuff for them and, you know, over time. But, I mean, it landed me into a spot where, I mean, it goes, there's so much that happened in between. But, I mean, just... My sponsor got to a point too because I'd just gotten paid, did all this, and I mean, my ego's still involved. And you know, he goes, you know, we're doing things differently because his biggest thing was drop the ego, surrender, take guidance. And he's like, you need to get a job. And I was like, a job.
Right.
I never had a job in my life.
Right.
You know, growing up, nothing. I never reported to a boss or anything. So.
Right.
And, you know, which was not a good thing because it was very intimidating. And, you know, I'd never had a boss or anything. So long story short is through mutual connections and mutual friends, I had known people that owned treatment centers and I'd rather go work for a place where at least I knew the people opposed to just some random place that made an offer and just, you know, I'd still feel awkward. And
so you northbound, you went right there without, that was, you knew the people? That,
I knew some of the owners at the time and you know, when I met with them, they were very... you know, they were very apprehensive as well. Cause I mean, a lot of them knew me and they actually tried helping me back in a while ago,
And
so they were kind of just like, you know, okay, we're going to take this chance with you basically. So they basically independently contracted me and I started doing client services and client advocate work there.
Okay. So that's what your title is, client advocate?
That's what it was initially. So Mike Netherton, you know, he was the vice president of Betty Ford Center for 21 years.
Oh, okay.
And then our other, I call him the Mickey Mantle of treatment. And then Paul Alexander, he was the first person to introduce collegiate programming into treatment. So you actually can go to school, get your KDAC, get your degree, get your GED, even take master's courses while you're in treatment. So those two together, I mean, it's like the Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth of treatment.
Yeah, and this is in Laguna Beach. Where are they?
This is in Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area.
Yeah, there's a lot of treatment there.
There is. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that Mike, from when he was at the Biddy Ford Center, he had created this position as the client advocate, which is basically like a sober mentor, sober companion. You know, so when new clients would come in, you'd go see them in detox, get them acclimated, get them acquainted. And you just share your personal truths and experiences. You don't have that authoritative figure like a case manager or a therapist. So if clients are really struggling or something, you'll meet with them as they're in detox and stuff, but as they transition into the community, they're just like, I want to get out of here. I can't do this. You know, that's where they'd send an advocate. Me at the time, it was just me. They'd send me over there. I'd take them out. We'd go get coffee and take them out of the element of treatment. I was just going to sit down and see what's going on. And as that worked so much because, you know, that authority figure was removed and they'd just sit down and talk to you. And before they knew it, you know, they'd forget that you were worked there. You know, they'd talk to you as like the sponsor and stuff. And it really, I mean, our ACAs, which is Leaving Against Clinical Advice, went down like 80%. From having something like that implemented. Now we have a whole team that's developed around that. So we have a female and a male advocate, which I help oversee and do a lot of stuff with their alumni. You know, I actually do a lot of marketing too. So
when you do a lot of these group acts, because I listened to you on Caleb. I know Caleb Aiken.
Oh yeah,
He's awesome. I listened to you on his podcast, and like all this shark swimming and business like that. Like you're big into the beach stuff, and you bring that like that natural high. Well,
So I mean, while doing the advocacy in the beginning, this was three years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I started with the advocacy, and I was like, look at these activities you guys have. I was like, they're okay, but they need to be. I mean, there's only so much miniature golf and bowling and movies you can do.
Right.
And this is when the company, you know, this is when they had 50, 60 beds. So, I mean, they were big and growing, but, I mean, we have 115 beds today.
That is a lot.
So, but, I mean, just with that, and we deal with, you know, the main demographic we deal with is 18 to 35. But a big thing is the natural highs is getting these people. You got to have motivation to want to stay clean. And, you know, and doing activities and being able to experience that. And, you know, your brain produces more potent chemicals than heroin, which is serotonin and dopamine.
Right,
and get that working right and stuff. It's pretty good. There's no feeling like when I catch a good wave or hit a perfect golf shot. There's no high that cocaine can give me like that or the amount of alcohol. But just to be able to really show them that they're, you know, that's just tools for them. That's just something that they can actually look forward to and enjoy. you know, we have big activities every Thursday. We do two activities a week, one smaller, one bigger, and could be anything from paintballing to deep sea fishing to bungee jumping. And, you know, parents at first are like, what the hell, I want to go. And it's like,
yeah.
You have to understand, a lot of these kids haven't genuinely laughed or had a good time in a long time. I mean, I've had a lot of my own family members go through, and cousins and brother and stuff go through Northbound. And, you know, to genuinely see them laugh, it's been like 5 years, and see them that they, hey, you can finish a round of golf and not have to be smashed. You know,
right.
Like when I used to play golf and I was using, it was like, okay, where's the booze? Where's the cocaine? I don't care if I have my golf clubs or my golf shoes.
Right.
I could rent those when I get there. You know what I mean? And so it was just like to be able to really see that and show that there's, you know, a life worth living is super important.
And so, like, is it like you go there every day kind of a thing?
I'm there every day, yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm there every day.
Are you going to get your KDAC or do something like that, you think?
I actually have the certificate. I finished the course. I just need to take the
CFS. Oh, I'm in it at UCLA. I did a year. That is not easy. You didn't say it's easy. I was like, oh, certificate, whatever.
Yeah.
Did you do it at UCLA?
No, I actually did it. We provide it through our
own schooling.
We have an activity program there, yeah.
Oh, wow. So you did all the coursework, you just haven't taken the test.
Yeah, so through our academy. So we have a full men's core, a women's core, you know, and then we actually have an academy where people actually can go back to school while they're in treatment. And then we have like
and
a
you provide
program.
All the teachers and everything?
Well, so they actually will facilitate. We have like tutors and we have case managers and stuff in that, but they'll actually go to college. They'll actually go to UCI, Saddleback. So we'll actually get them. Because our whole thing is we promote clients going back out to their natural stressors and bring it back into a controlled environment. Because we want them to get reacclimated to life.
And do you do know? Outpatient there too then?
We do. We're like the one-stop shop from detox to intensive IOP.
How often, what's the average length of time somebody stays?
5 to 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the reason why is because, I mean, a lot of the treatments I went to, you know, 30, 60, 90 days, it's not hard to stay sober when you're locked down in an environment. It's actually when you're able to live your life through the activities, through, you know, actually seeing that your life is getting better. We actually help with job placement, going back to school. And when you're doing all that, I mean, you're before you know it, your time's not, you're like, oh my God, that was 5 months has already gone by. Because, I mean, you slowly transition into different phases, which allows you more freedom. So it's like the first 30 days, it's like you're on a tight leash to kind of see what you're doing, but everything's on you. You know, you have to do your, you know, steps 1 through 3. You got to get a sponsor. You know, you have to do your step work. You have to, you know, there's certain things that you have to meet. And once you get there, you slowly start getting freedoms back, like your phone. You'll start being able to get deviations. You start going to outside meetings. You start going to places with your sponsor. You know, then by 90 days to 120, if you're doing what's asked of you, you know, and everything's going well, I mean, you'd be fully in school, have a job, and still live there and stuff like that. So it's really reintegrating people back into life. And we're keeping up with what society and everything's kind of depicting. We're not, you know, using the old model. That's the thing is when I go to these treatments and come out 90 days, it's like dropping you in the 405 saying, guess which way to go? Here's your phone, here's your car, here's everything. And it didn't, to me, it's especially in the younger culture, just with the accessibility things, it's so important to really help people get back into life, you know? And that's where I think the average length of stay is people come in 30 days, they're like, I'm not staying a day longer, you know? And then by the time they're there, it's like they're extended and it's, they're very open to it because it's stuff they would be doing on their own if they weren't in this environment, you know?
Right.
So that's the thing is, I mean, yeah, it's super, you know, it's very structured. I mean, we have a 120 employees, so there's more employees than there are beds, and, you know, or there is clients, so there's a lot, you know, we actually can really individualize people's program to what fits their need. There's like the shell of the actual facility, but, you know, in between, I mean, if somebody's really inclined with music or cars or different things, we can help, you know, individualize their program to be able to do certain things that they enjoy while maintaining the full, you know, the programming that they're doing.
Well, this sounds awesome.
We got to have you down for a tour.
For sure. For sure. So this is great. How can people, if people want to find you, you're on Twitter, of course.
Twitter, Instagram.
Okay. You're on all those. But, and Northbound.
Livingsober.com. Just how it's spelled.
Living Sober. And you have a blog on there, right?
I have a blog on there. I do a weekly blog for the Huffington Post.
And then where else are you? Like you go.
I do.
You'll talk about, you know.
I mean, I spoke at USC last week. I do. CNN. I'm going to be doing that a lot more, hopefully. Do stuff with Drew.
I saw your blog post about going on CNN. It was really sweet.
Oh, thank you. Did you see the one on Philip Seymour?
No, I don't think I saw that one. I'm so cynical about going on those TV shows, and I was really touched by, like, you were like, I'm on CNN. You know, like...
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I
was
a cynic.
It was just... And it was more... That's the thing. Is I'm using all these opportunities not to get back on into the limelight. It's more of to raise awareness, and like I said in the very beginning, to be able to relate to people. So
if somebody came along and they were like, Jason, this is, like, the TV show. You'd have to leave what you're doing, and it's like, is there any opportunity that would,
like, if it had to do with addiction and raise awareness, probably. Right. But if it has anything to do with like doing The Hills or other shows like that, no.
Right. Heard it here.
So Yeah, no, I think it's, you know, there's an amazing opportunity right now to, you know, be a voice for this. And, you know, it's really sad. I mean, I've seen too many people die, and I think that people need to start seeing that, you know, this is needs to be taken a lot more serious. And my hope is in the next 5 years, it's like, it's not like breast cancer, but I hope it's aware like breast cancer or AIDS or anything. I hope my goal is in the next year is to have a walk downtown.
I'm so down. Tell me what my company can do.
We're talking about that.
So I'll do whatever I can. Okay, Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You made it in time. Was he? I think that guy, I think he got a ticket. I think he got a parking ticket just so he could stay and keep talking about his passion for addiction and recovery. Don't pretend you weren't totally charmed by that guy. So follow him on Twitter. Go and support him in any way you can. I know I will be doing that. And yeah, and tell me your thoughts. And don't be afraid. I won't hear about your fear of giving this podcast a bunch of stars on iTunes. That is nothing to fear. That is something to embrace. And I will love you forever for doing it.